Welcome to the Space Show, presented by members of the Space Association of Australia. Hello, I'm Andrew Rennie. On this evening's The Space Show, we chat with a very disappointed Canberran about his space experiment. We have two editions of Space News. First edition, Space Show News.
All right, lift off when the clock is started.
Yes, sir, reading you loud and clear.
Roger, roll, Discovery.
Discovery, roger, go in front of us.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the July 8, 2020 edition of Space News. This is Peter Ould, and tonight I'm joined by Tina Stagg and Michael Abdullah, and we're all from the Space Association of Australia. And moving over to Rocket Lab, Rocket Lab's latest Electron mission failed to reach orbit after a problem during the rocket's second stage burn. Following a successful liftoff, first stage burn and stage separation, Rocket Lab experienced an anomaly during its 13th Electron mission called PIX, or It Didn't Happen. The issue, which occurred approximately 4 minutes after liftoff from Launch Complex 1 on the Mahia Peninsula last Sunday morning, resulted in the safe loss of the vehicle. Electron remained within the predicted launch corridors and caused no harm to personnel or the launch site. Payloads on board the launch vehicle were not deployed into orbit and were also lost. In a tweet and later a video posted by Rocket Lab after the mishap, the company's founder and CEO said, "We're deeply sorry to our customers Spaceflight Inc., Canon Electronics, Planet and InSpace Missions for the loss of their payloads. Today's anomaly is a reminder that space launch can be unforgiving, but we will identify the issue, rectify it, and be safely back to the pad as soon as possible." And that was Peter Beck. The primary payload for the launch was the CESAT-1B, a 67-kilogram imaging satellite by Canon Electronics, whose launch was arranged by Spaceflight Inc. The satellite, capable of taking images with a resolution of 90 centimeters, was intended to demonstrate the spacecraft technologies as the company prepared mass production of similar satellites. The rocket also carried 5 SuperDove imaging CubeSats developed by Planet. These satellites are upgraded versions of its original Dove line of CubeSats. The 7th satellite on the Electron was Faraday 1, a 6-unit CubeSat developed by a British startup InSpace Missions, the first in a series of satellites by the company designed to carry hosted payloads. Faraday 1 included payloads for several customers such as Airbus Defence and Space, which flew a payload called Prometheus 1 to test a reprogrammable software-defined radio. Rocket Lab is already working closely with the US Federal Aviation Administration to investigate the anomaly and identify its root cause to correct the issue and move forward. The anomaly occurred after 11 consecutive successful orbital launches of the Electron launch vehicle. Rocket Lab currently has more than 8 Electron vehicles in production, ready for rapid return to flight as soon as investigations are complete and any required corrective actions are taken.
And here is how that failure was described by New Zealand's One News.
A tough day, that from the founder of Rocket Lab after losing one of his Electron rockets in space. Called PIX, or It Didn't Happen, was the company's 13th launch. And as Laura James reports, Rocket Lab's promising to find the fault and get back on the pad soon.
3, 2, 1.
A successful liftoff.
But this was the last we saw of the Electron flight. It reached a peak altitude before beginning to fall back towards Earth.
It appears we have lost our video feed for today's mission.
We did experience an anomaly on the way to orbit that caused the loss of the rocket and the payload. It'll largely burn up as it breaks through the atmosphere.
The issue occurring about 4 minutes into flight.
This can happen for a number of reasons. Something that looks suspicious is that this came at a particular moment in the second stage burn when it swaps from one set of batteries to another set of batteries.
We will leave no stone unturned to figure out exactly what happened today.
Today's launch was fast-tracked by a day to avoid bad weather. On board, 7 satellites, including Earth imaging technology for Canon, and 5 observation satellites from San Francisco company Planet, which, in a statement, said,
"The risk of launch failure is one Planet is always prepared for. We have full faith that Rocket Lab will be able to bounce back from today's failure in no time."
An Electron mission costs nearly $11.5 million, not including the payloads.
The financial loss here is generally covered from our customers by insurance, but the bigger loss for us as a company is the time that it's going to take for us to investigate.
Such failures aren't uncommon.
One example is SpaceX, who had failures on their first launches. And they use these failures to make it better next time. Rocket Lab has been not failing at all, which is why this has come as a bit of a surprise.
Just about every launch vehicle in history experiences one failure. If you look at our track record compared to most, we're stand out. This probably hurts our pride a lot more than anything.
The company was planning monthly launches going forward, but for now,
we won't put another vehicle in the sky until we're really, really happy.
And just when that'll be is unknown. Laura James, One News.
Well, someone who has been affected by that is Dr. Steve Gower. Now, he's the Chief Executive Officer and Research Program co-leader of the Space Environment Management at Mount Stromlo Observatory. And I gather he's a pretty unhappy chap at the moment. Like myself, I guess that, Steve, you were watching the television from New Zealand on Sunday morning when the 13th Electron rocket was launched.
Yes, absolutely I was. And good evening, Andrew. Thanks for having me on.
Now, what was your particular interest in this launch?
Okay, so there were one of the satellites on board called Faraday 1 by InSpace Missions from the UK. We had what is known as a hosted payload on there. So this was a 6U CubeSat. So it's a 1U is 10 centimetres by 10 centimetres by 10 centimetres. So a 2U, which is a 3U, is a classic sort of bread size satellite. So we had 1U on that 6U satellite, and that was our payload. So,
and as you watched, when did you realise that things weren't going quite as planned?
Well, it's quite interesting. So I was a bit premature. I actually sent a note to one of my friends on a successful launch, because the first stage looked fantastic. Second stage was going well as well. But they had the telemetry up in the right-hand corner, and I actually noticed that the altitude started to drop, even though the second stage was still burning. So that sort of said something's going on here. Why are they losing altitude? So,
yeah.
So that alerted me to something going wrong. So.
Yes. The folks at the Rocket Lab, the public relations people there that were giving the commentary, the free picture froze, and then they signed off, and not a word that things had gone wrong.
No, that's right. Certainly not on there, but if you're following their Twitter feed, they were updating their Twitter feed faster than they were updating us. So we actually found out via the Twitter feed that something had gone wrong.
Twitter these days. Now,
yes.
As I say, your experiment was part of the English Faraday satellite. And did your part of it have a name?
Ours was just known as the CERC payload, or SPLD. The idea, and the very quick description of what it was. So on our payload, we had a little corner cube reflector. So they're like the cat's eye reflectors that go down the centre of the freeway. So the light from your headlights are reflected back. Exactly the same thing, much higher precision. And that was so we could bounce a laser off the satellite and measure the distance to the satellite and know exactly where it was. So there was a corner cube reflector. There was also a very bright LED light on board. So that was a what we know as a beacon. And so that we would turn that on when the satellite wasn't illuminated by the sun. So it's called non-terminator. So we could actually track it and see it during the dead of night. And the last thing that was on there was a special light detector. And what we would do is we'd shine a laser from the ground and it'd measure how bright the laser was. Laser communication with satellites is the next big thing. But our satellite was really not about doing laser communications. It was more about measuring the brightness of a laser through an adaptive optic system. Adaptive optic systems are things that astronomers use to take the twinkle out of the stars. It gives you a very clear image. So you're actually correcting for the atmospheric distortion. So we wanted to know how bright the laser would be with atmospheric distortion corrected for and without correcting for it.
Mm-hmm. Now, was this going to be deployed into its own orbit or would it remain part of Faraday?
It always remained part of Faraday. Right. So Faraday had other payloads on board as well, and some of them with Earth observation cameras. And so when we needed to use our payload, we'd actually rotate the satellite so the cameras were pointing out into deep space and we could actually then shine the laser on our detectors on board.
Australia has some experience with shining lasers at satellites, doesn't it?
Oh, we do. So we are the world leaders in satellite laser ranging. And Mount Stromlo has a satellite laser ranging station there, and it has one of the key points around the Earth for the Earth's terrestrial reference system. So because the Earth's plates are moving all the time, you need to know where you are with relation to something else using your GPS on your phone. And because those plates are moving, we need to make correction for those sorts of things. So the satellite laser ranging station on top of Mount Stromlo, so we tell the GPS satellites where they are, so the satellites can tell you where you are when you're out and about with your mobile phone, for example.
Now, you're with the Space Environment Research Centre, correct?
Yes, that's correct. So the CERC, as we know it, is funded by the Commonwealth Government as a part of the CRC program, Cooperative Research Centre program. So it's designed to get industry and academia working together on industry-based problems.
So that's your overall aim then?
Yes, yeah, so the Space Environment Management, CRC, so environment management, we might think we know what that is down on the Earth, but what does it mean in space? So we track about 20,000 objects at present, greater than the size of a grapefruit, about 10 centimetres across. Each of those objects go whizzing around the Earth on their own path. So the ones in low Earth orbit go about 7 or 8 kilometres per second, so they travel really, really fast. And so we track objects so we know whether or not there's going to be a collision. So that's just the environmental management part is about understanding where space objects are, being able to detect them better. If you can detect them better, you can track them better. If you can track them better, you can work out what orbits they're in better, and so you can predict where they'll be. And so what we're looking to do is to actually have a system of predicting collisions in space from space objects. Conjunction and threat warning analysis, as it's called. So.
Which brings me to another point then. You know when M2 Pathfinder satellite was launched last month for the Royal Australian Air Force? We here on the Space Show told our listeners that it was object number 45,727 in the Space Track catalogue of objects. Of course, not all of those are still in space, but there must be a lot more objects up there than the 10 centimetres or so size that is the minimum size to be included in the Space Track catalogue. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. So so that we track about 20,000 down to 10 centimetres. Between 10 centimetres and 1 centimetre, they think there are hundreds of thousands more. And below 1 centimetre, which you just cannot track, they believe there are millions. So the European Space Agency has, I think, 150 million or something like that, very small. So these are flakes of paint and stuff like that. There are there's been damage to the cupola window on the International Space Station from flakes of paint that have hit that, and the space shuttle as well in the window. So you can generally employ shielding for objects below about a centimetre in size, so like marble size. Anything larger than a marble, you can't really protect against. And just to give you an indication, and your listeners an indication, so a marble travelling at 7.5 kilometres a second, which is how fast space objects in low Earth orbit travel, it has the same kinetic energy as your one-tonne car travelling at 60 kilometres an hour. So if you think you can, your satellite can withstand being hit by a car doing 60 kilometres an hour, then you're safe against one centimetre marble-sized objects in space.
That must be quite a concern then for the operators of satellites.
Yes, it is indeed. So they try to shield satellites as best they can, but more importantly, most satellites, certainly the very, very large and sort of expensive satellites, have thrusters on board. And so they monitor the positions of their satellites, and they get a feed from the US government saying there's a potential collision. But then they need to make up their mind if whether or not they will move, because those potential collisions might be a kilometre away, 500 metres away. So if you were to move your satellite, are you actually moving into the path? So the error bars are really quite large on those things because the source data isn't very good. And so what we're doing at the Space Environment Research Centre is working out techniques to get better source data. And if you've got better source data, then you have much smaller error bars. And so you can then provide a service to satellite operators, which is about providing actionable alerts. This object will come within 5 or 10 metres of your spacecraft. You need to move it.
Uh-huh. And is it actually feasible for many satellite operators to actually dodge these other satellites?
Yes, it is. So most of the operational satellites have thrusters on board. The low Earth orbit ones, like the CubeSats and things that are put up, don't really have those. There is some work being done at present on, and there is a little bit of space heritage now on micro thrusters for these very small satellites. But by and large, satellites will have thrusters on board. They'll either be electric thrusters or gas-type thrusters. So Elon Musk with his Starlink satellites has Krypton gas thrusters on board. And so you ionise it through the Krypton gas, accelerate it through an electric field, and it provides some thrust.
And what about removing debris from orbit? Is that a feasible in any way?
Yes, it is. So so some of the work that we're doing is, and the whole idea of the payload on Faraday 1, we use high-power ground-based lasers to shine a light on the space debris, the space junk, and the very light particles hitting it. You can think about lots of little marbles hitting it. The light particles hitting it, the photons, provides a force. So it's called photon pressure. The light is not bright enough to ablate the surface, as in to erode it, and the light is certainly not bright enough to blow it into pieces. It's like the Hydra. You can deal with one piece, or you can cut its head off, and then you have two heads you've got to deal with. So we don't want to destroy it. We just actually want to use photon pressure to slightly change the orbit. And so the way to think about this is that if this piece of space junk, just imagine you're facing east and you see the rising sun coming up. If that rising sun was a piece of space debris and we shine the light on it, we actually slow the debris down. As it goes around the Earth, it comes back and we shine the light on it again and it slows it down. Every time we slow it down, it drops down into a lower orbit. So it should be technically feasible to deorbit space junk using ground-based lasers. Now, our particular technique applies to probably 10 or 15% of space debris up there. And if you can think about something the size and weight sort of thing of a television screen or a computer monitor. So they have very large surface area, but they're not all that heavy, so it's a high area to mass ratio. So we can actually deorbit space debris like that. there are some very, very large satellites in space that are no longer operational. And what we don't want, and they're in critical orbit, so we don't want those to be damaged by space debris or have a collision with space debris. And cause that could then shatter into thousands or millions of pieces. And so there are a few active debris removal programs who actually send up a satellite which grapples or connects to those large satellites. Envisat is one. The size of a bus, for example, it attaches it to the satellite and then uses its thrusters to push the satellite back down into Earth's atmosphere so it burns up in the atmosphere. So.
And what are the riskiest orbits then?
Allow me to put that question a little way. Instead of riskiest orbits, so the most congested orbit is about 850 up to about 1,500 kilometres. So there was a collision between an Iridium satellite and a defunct Russian satellite that littered that 800 to, let's say, 1,000 kilometres with enormous amounts of debris. And that's the sort of orbit that you want to put your Earth observation satellites in. So that's now a risky orbit, if you like. And so that's really very congested. So if you're going to plonk a satellite in that particular orbit, 800 up to, let's say, 1,500 kilometres, then there's a much higher probability of collision. It's still small, but much higher than being in an orbit that's out at 15,000 kilometres where the GPS satellites might be.
And does Australia have a role in trying to remove some of this debris?
So that's why we're here. So the federal government, as I said, funded through the Cooperative Research Centre program to actually look at techniques for actually removing space debris. And so we're in the process now of finalising the assembly of all of our experimental equipment. The COVID virus put us behind a little bit with the view to actually performing some experiments later on this year. And it's really about a proof of principle. We're not trying to actually deorbit a piece of space debris. It's more about changing the orbit of a piece of space debris. I mentioned earlier that CubeSats don't necessarily have their own thrusters on board to evade. So if you've got a space object that's still operational, that's going to potentially collide with a piece of space debris or another space object and neither have thrusters, then we may be able to change the orbit of one of those ever so slightly such that they miss. And you don't have that collision.
Well, back to your experiment then, Steve.
Yep.
Will you be trying another one?
The Faraday 1 payload, the CERT payload on Faraday 1, was really a calibration device. So it wasn't critical to our experiments, but what it allowed us to do was to work out the intensity of the laser on orbit, with the adaptive optic systems turned on and then with it turned off. We can still do the experiments, but we won't have that calibration. So the question is, will we know what force we're actually applying? There are some known objects, so we know how large they are, and we can work out the force that's actually applied by the change in orbit. Interesting, you mentioned M2 earlier. We actually had a payload on M1, and that failed. That actually made it to orbit but never phoned home. And so that's two from two for us. So we're not doing any more because we've run out of time. CRCs are funded for a particular period of time. So we will not have time to build another payload, get it into onto a satellite and launch manifest and launch during the lifetime of CERT. However, having said that, space is difficult. So we have a plan C and a plan D, given that plan A and B both failed. So plan C is one of our partners, NICT from Japan, actually have a laser communications satellite that's already on orbit. It's not designed to operate at the same colour light that we're of our lasers, but it's still sensitive enough to actually pick up light. So we'll be able to use their satellite to actually do the same experiments. So that's our next port of call to actually do that. So we've already had discussions. They have offered the satellite to be able to do that. And it's non-destructive is the important thing to say. So I've got to reopen that conversation now that Faraday 1 has failed.
Well, I hope things go better for you then in the future.
Yes, indeed, indeed.
Well, thanks for joining us on the Space Show.
You're more than welcome, Andrew. Our website is circ.org.au. If anyone wants to jump on and have a look at our research programs, what we do, more than welcome. There's a contact page there, which Andrew reliably tells me no longer works, but there is a phone number there that you can give us a call on. So,
okay, well, thank you. That's Dr. Steve Gower, the Chief Executive Officer. He's the research program co-leader at the Space Environment Management part of the Space Environment Research Centre in Canberra.